75 years ago this week, more than 150,000 Allied troops stormed the beaches of Normandy. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Dr. Adrian Lewis is the David B. Pettaway Professor of Military History at the University of Kansas. He specializes in the military history of the 20th century. He's the author of several books, including Omaha Beach, A Flawed Victory. He's also a retired U.S. Army Ranger, serving with the 9th Infantry Division and the 2nd Ranger Battalion. Welcome, Professor Lewis.
Happy to be here.
Before we get to D-Day itself, set the stage for us. By 1944, the U.S. had been involved in World War II for several years. Where did things stand in 1944?
Before D-Day, well, a number of events have to take place before you can get to the Normandy invasion. So, of course, on 7 December 1941, we get into World War II. 1942, we go into North Africa, Operation Torch. 1943, we go into Sicily and then into Italy. And then in 1944, we go into Western Europe, and that's the Normandy invasion. So all those events had to take place before this. You also had to win a couple of other battles. You had to win the Battle of the Atlantic, for example, to be able to get across there. So you had to maintain what we call the lines of communication between the United States and Europe and the United States and Britain. So you had to win the U-boat war. And then you had to win also the air war. Before you can conduct an amphibious operation, you need to be able to control the air above the battlefield. So as a consequence of that, air superiority was a prerequisite before the Normandy invasion. So there are a couple of things have to take place before the Normandy invasion can actually proceed.
It almost sounds like there's a checklist. We need to be able to do this. We need to be able to do this. We need to be able to do this before we can launch a
huge amphibious operation. Amphibious operations are very difficult. They're complex operations. And yes, there are prerequisites. There are things that have to happen before the actual assault takes place. Naval superiority in the vicinity is absolutely necessary. Air superiority above the battlefield. And if you can get it, and you can't always get it, but overwhelming firepower at the point of the landing is also. So we have experience. Remember the Marine Corps in the Pacific, Central Pacific, the U.S. Army in the Southwest Pacific. We've conducted a number of amphibious operations. So we have a fairly well-developed amphibious warfare doctrine at this time.
One of those operations in particular I want to talk about.
Okay.
D-Day was the largest amphibious operation of its kind, but it did have precedent. In June 1943, the Allied forces launched Operation Husky in Italy, which was at that time the largest amphibious operation to date. What lessons did the Allied forces learn from Operation Husky and some of those other amphibious operations going into D-Day?
You could say what lessons they didn't learn, too. Lessons learned and lessons we did not learn. First, let me point out that an amphibious operation is a joint operation. It involves naval forces and army forces, sometimes marine, and then air power also. So it's a joint, what we call a joint operation. At this time, the Air Force is in the United States Army. It's not separated until 1947, but still, the Air Force thinks differently. And so what I want you to understand is that each one of these services has a different vision of how this thing would take place. And what you have to do is get a joint doctrine for the conduct of an amphibious operation. Right? So if the Army was leading this thing exclusively, then it would be conducted one way. If the Navy was doing it exclusively, it'd be done another way. So I want you to understand that. And then the other problem with amphibious operations in the European theater is that they're combined operations. In other words, the British are also partners in this thing. And during the period that we're talking about, there's a transition that's taking place. The British had been the senior partner. So when we land in North Africa, the British have the greatest experience. They're more mobilized. They fought the Germans. So they have experience that the Americans don't have. By the time you get to Sicily, we have fought the Germans. We're a little bit better, but the British are still the dominant partner in this relationship. By the time we get to Normandy, the Americans have become the dominant partner in this relationship, and it will remain that way throughout the rest of World War II. So all of those things come into the complexities of developing an amphibious operation and amphibious doctrine. Sicily was the largest amphibious operation up to that point in time. Actually, in terms of putting troops ashore in a 24 to 48 hour period. It was actually larger than the Normandy invasion in that sense. But there are more ships, more aircraft involved in Normandy than in Sicily. But Sicily was also the first time they had all the LSTs, the landing ship tanks, the landing craft, all those new developments, all that new technology that was put in place to conduct an amphibious assault was also the first time it was used was Sicily. They didn't have this stuff in North Africa in 1942, but in Sicily they do have this. So it is sort of, you could make an argument, a sort of a dress rehearsal for the Normandy invasion. However, I should also point out that there were disagreements. The Navy did not completely agree with the Army's approach to the conduct of amphibious operation. Then the U.S. Navy didn't agree with the British in terms of their approach. So there's disagreements about the conduct of amphibious operations between the two partners here.
Germany expected an Allied invasion, perhaps not on June 6th, perhaps not at Normandy Beach, but they expected something somewhere.
That's right.
Describe the Atlantic Wall and the series of fortifications that Germany had built up along Northern Europe in anticipation of an Allied assault.
Well, the preparations start soon after the fall of France, but it takes a while for them to develop it. It is when the Germans turn towards Russia, right, the vast majority of resources go to fighting Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union, largest land invasion in history. However, there's thought given to what they call the Atlantic Wall and the defense. It is in December 1943, that Hitler asked Rommel to do a survey, to do an inspection of that defense. Rommel comes back and the report is not positive on the quality of that defense, and Hitler puts Rommel in charge, and Rommel then starts to change the character of the defense there. He pulls more resources in, and as a consequence of expectations, Hitler shifts priority from the Eastern Front to the Western Front, so that when we land there are almost 60 divisions in Western Europe. Well, I want you to understand that too, because we could have lost with 60 divisions in Europe. If they had known the exact location of the landing, they could have met us there with overwhelming force. So when you think about the Normandy invasion, there's some historians who make the argument that the outcome was inevitable. I disagree with that totally. We could have lost at Normandy. It was not, there was doubt about it, is the point I want to make.
So take us to June 6th, 1944. Can you walk through how the invasion took place, or perhaps take us to June 5th, 1944 and set the stage as they're ready to invade the beaches of Normandy?
Okay, let me see if I can do that. So you're a soldier in the Big Red One, 1st Infantry Division, which by the way is in Kansas here at Fort Riley. So you're a soldier in the Big Red One. Let's say that you're one of those soldiers that have been with the division for several years, which means you landed in North Africa and then you landed in Sicily. As a matter of fact, the reason Big Red One is doing this is because it had so much experience. There were two divisions that were pulled out of the Mediterranean for this invasion because they had amphibious warfare experience. General Omar Bradley, who is the commander of the 1st Army that's landing at Normandy, he intentionally asked for experienced forces, and they pulled the 1st Infantry Division and the 9th Infantry Division out of the Mediterranean, and then they bought them over to England for this invasion. So the Big Red One is going to lead the way at Omaha Beach, and the 4th Infantry Division is going to lead the way at Utah Beach, followed up by the 9th Infantry Division. So those divisions will lead the way. The 29th Infantry Division, which is a National Guard division called the Blue and the Gray, which is a Virginia and Maryland division, it will also land there. And 29th Infantry Division didn't have the combat experience, but the 1st Infantry Division has operational command for the Normandy invasion. So let's say you're in England and you've been waiting for this thing to take place, and you're a soldier in the Big Red One. The landing has been postponed several times, so you've been sitting waiting in these ships, and then finally there's a break in the weather, and Eisenhower gives the command to commence the operation, right? Then you have to traverse the English Channel, and then you arrive in the morning at what we call a park area, where the ships will stop, and then they commence amphibious operations. So the command is given, and you're on one of those ships. And then they lower the landing craft over the sides of the ships there. The waves are about 6 feet high, so the conditions aren't great. We're about 12 miles off the coast now, so you still have quite a ways to go in these small landing craft. And so soldiers will then start going over the cargo nets, lowering down into the boats. And they have to be very careful here because the landing craft, they ride on top of the water. The ships sit in the water. So alongside, the landing crafts are going up and down along the side of the ship. If you time this thing wrong, you're going to have quite a drop. And if you time it wrong the other way, you could get crushed against the side of the ship. So soldiers will go over the side. They will drop their rucksacks, their weapons into the landing craft, and then they will get into these things. As each one of the boat landing craft is complete it, you know, it's filled, it will go out and it will start circling, waiting for the other boats in that particular boat division to go. And imagine, it's completely dark down there. And the Navy was pretty good to the Army that they fed them bacon and eggs, and they had a full breakfast there. And then they get out there in that water, and some of them start getting seasick, and they barfing up the breakfast that the Navy had fed them. And then once an entire boat division is assembled and they're using flags and other symbols, then they start in towards the shore. All right, so you imagine yourself again, you're one of the soldiers in the Big Red One. There are different types of soldiers there. There are soldiers who have never seen combat, but there are soldiers with a great deal of experience. Those soldiers that have never seen combat are, you know, sort of wondering how they're going to do, what's coming. And those soldiers that have seen combat who've lost friends are wondering, is it my time? Is this going to be the end for me? So there are different thoughts going through soldiers' minds as they head towards the beach. As they move in towards the beach, they notice a couple of things. One of the things that they notice as they start approaching it is the DD tanks. Now, these are what we call duplex drive tanks, and they had a canvas shroud, and they are supposed to provide the tank support on the beaches. And one entire battalion went almost, of the 35 tanks, 30 of them went to the bottom of the ocean. The canvas shroud could not stand up to the conditions, the weather conditions, and as a consequence of that. So as you're in your landing craft and you're hitting in, you can see soldiers from these tanks off, you know, in the water there trying to swim, trying to survive after their tanks have sunk. And then you start moving closer to the beaches, and you can see the battleships and cruisers that will open up. They will start firing onto the beaches, and you can imagine what that looks like. The USS Arkansas, the USS Nevada, two of the oldest battleships in the fleet there, they start opening up on the beaches. It sort of gives you that warm, fuzzy feeling, you know, everything's going to be all right. The beach defenses will be destroyed. As you move in, you then see what we call these LCTRs, and these are landing crafts that have rockets on them. And you see all these rockets just shoot up into the air. And again, you know, you get that feeling that yes, the beach defenses will be destroyed. And as we get closer and closer, then you get more comfortable with these things. All right? As you start, it's an overcast day, but there are breaks in the cloud. So again, as you're heading in, you look up in the air and you see these bombers, right? These daylight precision bombers of the U.S. Army Air Force, and they're hitting in towards the beaches, and you know they're going to drop bombs all along those beaches there. Right? So you have all these expectations from these LCTRs, from the battleships and cruisers that opened up on the beaches, and then from the bombers, right? And then as the sun comes up and you can start see the outline of the beaches, that's when things start to go wrong. You start looking and you see the German defenses, they're in complete tact. They have not been destroyed. All those obstacles that you expected to be bombed and blown up by naval gunfire, they're still intact. The Air Force, all those bombs that they dropped, they missed. They landed behind the beaches. And as you come into as you come into the beaches, come into focus, you start to realize everything is intact. The German defenses are completely intact, and they are manned and ready to kill Americans, which they proceed to do. So at 0630, when that first landing craft hits the, and that ramp comes down, machine gun fire, mortar fire, artillery fire, everything just opens up on the soldiers of the Big Red One and the 29th Infantry Division. Those first hours are a mess. I make the argument in my book, The Omaha Beast, that we should have lost. The actual plan for the invasion fails, but soldiers rise to the occasion. In other words, they improvise another plan on those beaches, and that's how we ultimately overcome the German defenses at Omaha Beach. But everything that they had been told about naval gunfire, the rockets, the plan for clearing the obstacles, none of that stuff works. None of that stuff happens at Omaha Beach. Turns out to be a very bloody day for the United States with 2,000 casualties at Omaha Beach.
So why didn't we lose?
Omar Bradley, in his book, and I think he's correct, gives credit to the men of the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry Division. He makes a point to say that had he chosen another division, a green division, one that had not seen combat, we probably would have lost Omaha Beach. I think he's right. We had General Eubner, commander of the division, General Norman Cota, who was his ADC, the assistant division commander, for this thing. Some of the regimental commanders and the battalion commanders there, all the way down to lieutenants. We had great soldiers and great leaders at Omaha Beach. And I agree with Omar Bradley that the Big Red One is what made the difference. Had a green division landed at Omaha Beach, we would have lost. Right? Let me just say that of all the operations conducted by the armed forces of the United States in World War II, the Normandy invasion is the most important. Japan could not win World War II. Only Germany could win World War II. Japan's strategy and thinking was based on the principle that Germany would win. And so when you think about that, only Germany has the potential to win World War II. So in terms of that, the Normandy invasion for the British and the Americans is the most important operation because it guarantees the destruction of Nazi Germany. Right? It once the landing is successful, the outcome of World War II, there will be setbacks, the Battle of the Bulge and other things there, but the outcome is now clear. With the Russians coming in on the Eastern Front and the Americans and British and Canadians coming in on the Western Front, Germany, its fate is sealed with the success of the Normandy invasion. So its importance of all the operations that we conduct in World War II, the Normandy invasion is the most important in terms of the destruction of Nazi Germany.
So by the end of June 6, 1944, 150,000 troops have landed along this 50-mile stretch of beach. Take us to June 7th, June 8th, June 9th. What happens next?
A great deal, particularly in the American sector, none of the D-Day terrain objectives was achieved. In other words, they thought they would be much deeper than they actually were. And the Americans at Omaha Beach had just, they were just inland, so none of the terrain objectives that they thought they would achieve on D-Day was achieved. So the next part of this thing is the breakout from the encirclement. The Germans are slow to respond to the Normandy invasion because they think another invasion is possible. So we had this thing called Operation Fortitude, which was a huge deception plan, right? And they created a artificial army, and I mean artificial. They had fake tanks, fake artillery pieces, so it's essentially balloons that were shaped like tanks, and they created thousands of those to create the image that there would be another assault, and that Normandy was not the main assault, but a secondary affair, and that the main assault will come into the area of the Pas-de-Calais area. So the Germans believed that, and as a consequence of that, they the 15th Army, that one of their strongest, sat there waiting for the main event to take place, or what they believed was the main event to take place. And that was fortunate. But still, at Normandy, the Germans did reinforce, and as a consequence of that, they tried to create a perimeter around the beachhead that has been established. So the next thing that you have to do is conduct a breakout. And there are things that we just did not anticipate. With what became known as the Bocage country, and fighting through hedgerow and hedgerow and hedgerow of things, it became a slugfest, at least in part, until we get to the breakout at St. Lo, where Omar Bradley will, the breakout will take place. And then a guy named Patton, will Third Army will come into existence, and that's when we start seeing rapid advances take place. Let me just say to your audience that if you have the opportunity to go to Normandy, there is a an American cemetery that overlooks Omaha Beach. It's American territory in France, and thousands of Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice are buried there. It's your tax dollars maintain it. It's a beautiful place. It's a sacred place. And if you ever have the opportunity, I recommend it. When I was teaching at West Point, I used to take cadets over. And you can go from one American cemetery to the next American cemetery to the next, all the way into Germany. United States made significant sacrifices for the liberation of Western Europe. I was standing on Omaha Beach trying to explain the landing to cadets. So I had 20 cadets surrounding me. They were standing literally on the beach, and I'm trying to explain the and parts of the invasion don't make sense. You know, for example, why did they do it at 06:30 in the morning? If your most accurate fire system is naval gunfire, why didn't you do it the way the Marine Corps did it in the Pacific? Why didn't you pull up there with battleships, cruisers, and destroyers and blow the heck out of that beach and then conduct the a landing, right? So you have to explain the rationale behind what takes place and why we do what we do at Normandy. And part of it is disagreements between the British and Americans, and also between the operational commanders and the tactical commanders. The men of the Big Red One who landed there wanted to land at night. They wanted to land under the cover of darkness the way that they did in North Africa, the way that they did in Sicily. So when they heard they were doing a daylight assault, they were not happy with that idea. So there's disagreement about the actual conduct of the invasion, how to go about it.
Dr. Lewis, dozens of movies have been made about World War II, and a number of them feature the dramatic landing of American troops on Normandy Beach on D-Day. Do you have a favorite movie or two?
I like Saving Private Ryan. I think that's excellent movie. And there was one that came out recently, Fury, about the tank war in Europe there, and that one is well done, and it shows the nastiness of war. Too many movies glorify it and don't show you the nastiness, the ugliness of war. And so those would be two of the top. When I give talks on the Normandy invasion there, I do have to say that Saving Private Ryan, you have to be careful with it. They give you impressions that are incorrect. So, for example, one of the impressions that you get is that the it takes 20 to 30 minutes and they're up on the beaches. No, that battle's going on all day. They are not. It is not a 20. And all you're actually seeing in Omaha Beach is 6 miles long. Multiple regimental combat teams are landing there. So what you're actually seeing is about a battalion-sized battle. In other words, you have to multiply that about 10 times to actually get the magnitude of what you're seeing there. Omaha Beach is a lot longer. Trying to get across that area to get to the bottom of that bluff there. It was. It was a stretch there. And it was littered with bodies as you try and get across that stretch of beach covered with minefields and obstacles. And so it gives you an incorrect impression in that way. Having said that, I talked to veterans who were at Omaha Beach, and they thought it was fairly realistic that that in terms of showing the carnage, and particularly that opening scene, which I think Steven Spielberg actually took, you know, almost from one of the records of one of the soldiers there, where the ramp falls down and a German machine gunner automatically has them, and he starts the process right there. That actually happened. There are, you know, accounts of soldiers that show that. So in that sense, a great job was done by Steven Spielberg in trying to show what war is like, the carnage, you know, the sights and sounds of the battlefield.
When you teach military history, what lessons do you think can be learned from the D-Day invasion?
Can I put that in a larger context in the sense that When I teach the World War II course, I tell my students that it is the most significant event in the 20th century, politically, socially, in terms of technology. The geographic boundaries of the world are set at this time. I cannot overemphasize the importance of World War II to the world that you live in today. You cannot understand the world that you live in today without understanding World War II. Let me just give you a couple of examples. World War II creates the two superpowers. It creates the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet Union will come out of there, the two dominant powers on the planet. World War II means the end of imperialism. It means that the British and the French empires are going to collapse. It's going to take a while, but that is the case. They're going to collapse. And that era will start the process of decay and will ultimately go away. Think about technology. Think about your ability to get in a jet and fly. Jet aircraft are developed. The Germans will develop that in World War II. That technology will be developed there. The first guided missile, the V-2 rocket, is developed in World War II. When you think about your cell phone and that satellite technology that you have right there, you have to go back to World War II. And probably the most significant piece of technology ever developed in human history, the atomic bomb, is developed in World War II and employed. So when you think about your life today and the technology that comes out of World War II, when you think about the geography of the world, when you think about the American role, I mean, before World War II, you know, we did not have bases that stretched around the planet. The United States provides the majority of security on planet Earth to this day. And, you know, U.S. Navy sails the oceans of this planet. You know, one American aircraft carrier can generate more combat power than just about most countries on the planet. So the role that we perform today comes out of World War II, comes out of that Cold War period. And so, again, you cannot understand the world that you live in today without understanding World War II. 70 million people were killed in World War II. There's nothing like it throughout the annals of human history that compare to World War II. And hopefully there never is, but the technologies that come out of it, the geographic boundaries of the planet, even social change, women in the workforce, the civil rights movement, the integration of the armed forces of the United States, which will take place in with the executive order by President Truman in 1948. There are so many changes. I mean, the Holocaust starts us to rethink, you know, what racism actually means. So that in every way, politically, socially, culturally, technologically, World War II shapes the world that we live in. It is the most significant event in the 20th century. Without question.
And D-Day made it possible for the Allied forces to win.
Yes, absolutely.
Dr. Adrian Lewis is the David B. Pittaway Professor of Military History at the University of Kansas. He's the author of several books, including Omaha Beach, A Flawed Victory. Dr. Lewis, thank you for coming in today.
Happy to do it.
We've got more about the 75th anniversary of D-Day coming up on KPR Presents right after this.